Hello and welcome to the EMJ podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. Joining me today for the first episode in a fascinating two-part series is Professor George Bakris, an esteemed American nephrologist at the University of Chicago in the US of A, where he serves as director of the Comprehensive Hypertension Center. George was educated initially at Indiana University, then obtaining his medical degree from the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science in the Windy City, and his residency at the University of Illinois Hospital and Health Sciences System and Mayo Clinic with his fellowship at the University of Chicago Medicine. He's board certified in internal medicine, is a member of several medical professional organizations, such as the American College of Physicians, the American Society of Hypertension, American Diabetes Association, American Society of Nephrology, the National Kidney Foundation, and the American Heart Association. In addition to having a curriculum vitae packed with hundreds of published articles, George has also served on over 15 editorial boards and has a host of awards and honors to his name, including an honorary degree from the University of Athens in Greece and the Irvin Page Alva Bradley Lifetime Achievement Award to acknowledge his outstanding contributions to medicine. During his high school and college days, George wrote and performed songs in a band, but he's made it very clear to us that he made his name in medicine and was never famous for this. Professor George Bakris, welcome to the EMJ podcast.
Well, Jonathan, thank you for that introduction, which I must admit was one of the most extensive I've ever had in my career.
When I've been fortunate enough to be, invited to speak somewhere and they read out my CV, my first reaction is to think, who the hell is this person? And my second is to go to the podium and say, I would now like to drop dead with these sounds of affirmation ringing in my ears. But George, before we get into the meaty stuff, a couple of questions. Used to visit Indiana, as I told you, with some frequency. And everyone I visited in India, for those who don't know, residents of the state of Indiana call themselves Hoosiers, H-O-O-S-I-E-R-S, Hoosiers. Every single person from Indiana I have asked has told me some nonsensical story about people knocking on a door in the middle of the night and saying, who's there? So first of all, I want to know what Hoosier mean. And second, I want to know about your band. What were they called? What sort of music did you perform? And do you still play music?
Well, I'm going to give you, I think, an unsatisfying answer to the first question, because like you, when I've asked the question, I've gotten a variety of answers. And one of the things that I heard is Indiana was predominantly rural. And there was a lot of intermarriages going on, a lot of sex happening in a variety of areas. And, you know, the comment was made, well, who's your mother? So now, is that true? I have no idea. So the answer is, I'm not really sure beyond folklore where that actually was derived. But you're 100% correct. Especially in southern Indiana, it's used a lot.
Yeah, I'm one of those people. I'm insufferable. I hate not knowing what a word means. So tell us about the music.
So when I was in high school, I was very interested in music. I liked music. I'd learned to play the guitar on my own, and I had a pretty good ear for music. And I had my cousin. I had a good friend. And we all lived within two blocks of each other. So we would get together, and then one thing led to another. And of course, the Beatles were huge back then, as were the Stones. And so we used them as kind of a model prototype. And we started writing stuff just for fun. And then we actually had a friend who knew somebody that had a recording studio. Long story short, we went, we recorded. And then one of my cousin's friends was in radio and TV in college. And he was doing disc jockeying on the weekends. So we played it for him, and he said, you know, I really like this. Let me play it on the air. We'll get phone calls. Let's see. So he did. And a lot of phone calls, very positive response. We were ready to go. We sent a letter to Nashville that, you know, we'd like to come down and do some recording. And we had written by then at least 15 songs. And so we got you know, during the time we were waiting for a response, there was a group called Bread. We were called the Herd.
Oh, yes, of course.
We were called the Herd. And then David Gates and Bread came out with I Want to Make It With You.
Yeah.
The chord progression was exactly the same as ours. The lyrics were different, but and the melody overlapped. And so we thought, okay, now we're going to get sued for plagiarism because we were not the first one out there. In the meantime, we get a letter back saying, we like you. We'd like to record you. However, you need to pay us $5,000 up front, and then you'll get that back in sales as we come. Well, this was 1969. $5,000 was a lot of money. Between the four of us, because we had a drummer by then, we had $300. So the conclusion was, I was always torn at that point because I always loved medicine. Should I do music? Should I do medicine? And so God speaks to you in mysterious ways. And this was a message I think I got. So we left and went, or at least I left and went into medicine.
No, I tried to play the guitar, and my guitar teacher told me it would be a service to humanity if I stopped. True story. I was awful. But I love music, and I have the same immense regard for musicians as I do for people who can speak more than one language, because it is a language. And I'm very lucky to have musicians as dear friends, both classical and rock musicians who've been very successful. But there's quite a few doctors who've kept their music going. A buddy of mine who's been on this podcast, Carl Hauser, he's a professor of, he's a trauma surgeon and professor in Boston. And Carl started a rock band also in the late 60s called the Druids of Stonehenge. And they are still together and they are still recording. And they are superb. So if you like rock, check out the Druids of Stonehenge. And I'm going to be Googling your band and see what I can come up with.
Well, I love this. And now, just as a parenthetical note, the head of the NIH is a hematologist oncologist. Uh-huh. And a geneticist fundamentally, and he actually found a cure, and I do mean cure, for sickle cell disease. And this is not going to be made available. It's going to be very pricey because it involves, you know, transfecting bone marrow cells, etc. But the bottom line is he has a band with the head of biochemistry, I think, at the NIH, and they play together and they do nightclub gigs. So very
there's also a British band, again, I hope the people listening are in, they thought they were just going to get hypertension. Stick around here, you get so much more. You know, we're Renaissance men. So there's a British band who I have known for donkey's years called Instant Sunshine. And Instant Sunshine was started by three medical students in London, and they have remained together. They're all now getting up there, and they sort of do like music hall style songs in the style of Flanders and Swann, if anyone remembers or knows who they were. And they're very witty and very, very gentle humor of a kind that's probably not that popular today because there's no deleted expletives. But again, practicing physicians, musicians, I love it. So anyway, I guess we ought to get into the medicine a wee bit. First of all, tell us how you got into medicine, nephrology, your interest in hypertension. Very often there's a particular person or an event that takes people down their path.
Well, I was always interested in the sciences, and so my parents tell me when I was in grade school, and especially when we were doing biology in junior high, I was really into it. And then my father had a heart attack when I was in junior high, and I became even more interested then. And then he subsequently passed away when I was a sophomore in high school. And at that time, the science was really appealing to me, but it became even more appealing. And I really got into it, taking, even in high school, they had advanced science courses my senior year. So I took those, and clearly I was going to do medicine. I wasn't really interested in business. I wasn't interested in other things. So a little myopic, but you know, that was what was driving me.
And so the hypertension interest, because your father had had a...
Well, no. So I was very interested actually in cardiology. And when I started in medical school, one of the rules I teach the students is you're going to know what you want to do based on your junior year, at least in the U.S., when you're doing basic science kinds of things. And if you wake up and love anatomy, then you should be a surgeon. If you wake up and love physiology or pharmacology, you should probably be an internist. And that's really, for me, what pushed me in that direction. And I loved physiology and I loved pharmacology. So when I started at the Mayo Clinic, they had rotations there in cardiology, which I started with, and I absolutely loved it. I thought it was amazing. And, you know, as I did other rotations, I wasn't really turned on by a lot of things. And at that time, hypertension was being done both by cardiology and nephrology there. So long story short, I was invited. This is a publishable event. I was invited in 1985 to be a cardiology fellow at the Mayo, which was like, you maybe had to sell your soul to do that. And I turned it down. And I turned it down because I wasn't really good with my hands. And I, at that time, interventional cardiology was coming into its own. And I knew I had to spend time in a cath lab and I didn't want to kill anybody. And I knew I had to do it. I couldn't get out of it. So I elected inappropriately, I might add in retrospect, that I wasn't going to do that. And so the compromise, because I was actually in the lab at the time doing experiments involving the heart and the kidney. And so my mentor at that time said, listen, well, at least do nephrology. I said, but I don't like dialysis. He goes, do nephrology, and then your science will take you where you want to go. And so I did. And that's how I ended up at the University of Chicago. And as part of that journey, Leon Goldberg, the late Leon Goldberg, had come to Mayo. Leon was the head of clinical pharmacology. And Leon met me. We had a meeting, a research meeting, and he met me and he asked me, you know, what I wanted to do. So I told him, he says, this is perfect. He says, if you come, he says, you're going to spend your time, research time with me. You'll learn hypertension. You'll learn pharmacology and it shouldn't be a problem. I'll talk to your boss. Okay. Well, he did. And that's how I ended up both with clinical pharmacology and nephrology when I finished. And the clinical pharmacology team at that time was doing all the hypertension. So that's when I was really exposed to it. And I realized that this was really an art because the physiology was still expanding at that time in terms of understanding what's going on. And at the same time, new drugs were being developed and you could really be creative in what you were doing. And the rest evolved over time.
You know, I'm thinking back to my medical school days. I still remember the lecture on Starling's Law of the Heart by the professor of physiology. And I was so petrified of this man that I thought the one thing I also could never figure out, you know, whether a murmur was between systole and diastole or whether it was a click, a thump, a whir. I thought, now I need stuff I can cut out. So, yeah, but you're right. You get that sort of calling. So, George, most of our listeners are medical professionals, but we get a lot of interested lay people who also listen in. And as director of the Comprehensive Hypertension Center, you oversee the interpretation of ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, a technique providing information about blood pressure over a 24-hour period, including during sleep. I know that every time I go for a checkup, I'm a pilot and I have to have an annual physical. Mm-hmm. And every time I go and have my physical, the first reading, you know, it's through the roof. I have white coat syndrome, I guess you call it. And then, of course, yeah. I sit quietly and it comes back down to sensible levels. Tell us about ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, because it was a new one to me.
So ambulatory blood pressure monitoring is relatively new, but it's not that new. It has been around for easily 25, 30 years. And the devices and the sensors have all been perfected and they're still being perfected. But it is a nice way to measure blood pressure at night as well as during the day. And it gives you a lot of information that you will never get from an office reading. Now, a couple of things. yes, if you have white coat hypertension, that will immediately define whether you do or not. And one of the points I'll make to the audience is white coat hypertension is not just because you're afraid of the doctor. Any anxiety-producing situation, irrespective of the environment, is going to cause your blood pressure to go up. The people very sensitive to this are older people, meaning people over 60, and people that have very stiff arteries. So those are people generally in their 70s and 80s. Now, how you know you have stiff arteries? Subtract the top number from the bottom number. And if it's 70 or higher, you've got stiff arteries, because it should be about 40. Now, the other thing is, that doesn't mean that if you're younger, you can't have this. So there are people that respond to situations in a very anxious way. If they're wanting, you know, if they're not sure, if they're afraid, and that will drive blood pressure up in a subset of individuals. That is something that you need to deal with. It is not, nobody really, there's no treatment for that. Well, there actually is, but nobody wants to be on anxiolytics. So you really need to teach yourself how to calm down, and you need to teach yourself what are the situations that prompt this. And if you are feeling anxious, then you can pretty much be sure your blood pressure is going up. And then what you do is you catch yourself, get your mind clear of that situation. If you can, go to a quiet space and do some slow, deep breathing exercises. 15 seconds in, 20 seconds out. Do that for 5 to 10 minutes and things will be fine. But if you don't do that, as you get older, it's going to catch up with you.
Yeah, I've talked previously on this podcast and written about the benefits of mindfulness and meditation and yoga, obviously exercise, but simple things like just going for a walk in a natural setting, it always makes me personally feel calmer and more serene. I have a friend, and I hope you're listening, who has been a GP for many years. He has never checked his own blood pressure. And I love him like a brother, and it drives me mad that not a lot of people do it. And in fact, I have another friend here in London who's also been on this podcast, and he had a stroke. He's a fit guy, rides bicycles, you know, very fit. No, right. I've seen, the expression in Britain is that I've seen more fat on a chip. And at the age of 50, he had a major stroke and was hemiplegic. Thankfully, he made a great recovery. But he admitted, right. And the guy's a nephrologist, for goodness sake, never checked his blood pressure. Bonkers.
I'll tell you an anecdotal story. One of my mentors from afar was a guy named John Swales mm-hmm. in Leicester. And a very good friend of mine, we've been friends for over 2 decades, is Brian Williams in London, mm-hmm. at UCL. And Brian was working with John Swales at that time as a junior person. And, you know, John told him he had an innocent murmur. And Brian said, well, you should get that checked out. He goes, no, it's an innocent murmur. We'll be okay. And they were in a bookstore. They walked out of the bookstore and John dropped dead right there. Brian tried to resuscitate him. He couldn't. So the consequence was innocent murmur. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, we've all lost people that we love and care for. And yeah, so anyone listening, get your blood pressure checked. So tell us about evaluating specific markers of kidney disease progression and how they relate to a heightened risk of a cardiovascular event. And also, you mentioned stiffening. Talk to us about stiffening, cardiac and renal function.
Well, first of all, let's take the easy one. How do you assess renal disease or kidney disease, and how do you put it together with cardiovascular risk? And so, number one, you need two components to properly assess kidney function. One is the estimated GFR, which you derive from serum creatinine, and the second is a spot albumin creatinine ratio. You need both. If you don't have both, you're only getting a half-ass diagnosis, and you could be way off. So you need both. Now, if you have a GFR less than 60, your cardiovascular risk immediately starts going up, And there's a beautiful paper published in the New England Journal in 2004 from the Kaiser Permanente group in California, over a million people, where they looked at this. It turns out if your GFR is 44 or less, you have almost a five-fold increased risk for all-cause mortality and over an 11-fold increased risk for cardiovascular events. If it's less than, if it's between 45 and 59, the risk is also increased, but about half of that. So it's still significantly increased. So basically anybody with a GFR below 60 and or a urine albumin that's 300 or greater is at very high cardiovascular risk. Moreover, there's a recent paper just published that if you have what used to be called microalbuminuria, now called severe albuminuria, that's between 30 and 299, your risk for heart failure is significantly increased. So you need those two variables, period. Otherwise, you really don't know where you are. Now, second point, if you want to maximally slow kidney disease progression, the two most common causes in the world for kidney disease progression to dialysis are diabetes, by far number one, and a very close second, hypertension, poorly controlled. That together accounts for about 68% of everybody on dialysis. So you really need to pay attention to what you're doing with those people. The normal rate of decline in kidney function in normal people is about 0.8 mLs per minute per year. Now, if you have diabetes, totally uncontrolled, uncontrolled hypertension, you're losing 10 to 12 mLs per minute per year. So at that rate, you'd be on dialysis if you lived in 12 to 13 years. So if you do everything properly, as we know today, and we don't have time for this, but I'll give you the reference. You can go to Diabetes Care, the September issue. There's an invited review that we did that covers everything. I'm going to just summarize it by saying you have to be on a blocker of the renin-angiotensin system. You have to be on an SGLT2. You should be on finerenone, a non-steroidal MRA, if you have albuminuria above 30. And lastly, you'll find out about this next year, the results of the FLOW trial, which is a GLP-1 RA agent for diabetes control. And everybody thinks now it's the cure for obesity, but in non-obesity reducing doses, looks like it's beneficial to slow progression of kidney disease. So you need those four pillars of therapy, and that pillars of therapy concept I'm stealing from the heart failure cardiologists. So we really, if you know what you're doing and the patient understands, that's critical, patient understanding, then you really can have a major dent in progression of kidney disease. Now, stiffness. Anybody with kidney disease is going to have some type of arterial stiffness, largely because they're older. And it'd be unusual if you have somebody that's 40 that has a high amount of stiffness. But if you compare people that are 40 with kidney disease to other people that are 40 without kidney disease, they have relatively greater stiffness. And why is that important? Well, the way the vessel reacts, whether it dilates, constricts, is a function of nitric oxide release. And that nitric oxide release comes from the endothelial cell in the artery. If your vessels are stiff, you will get reduced into nitric oxide release, and hence the vasodilatory effect will be blunted. And that's one part of the reason you're getting a large delta between systolic and diastolic pressure when the heart pumps. And so you cannot reverse that. But usually people that have this prematurely have some type of genetic bent. In other words, their parents probably had it. They just didn't know it because nobody talks about it. But they also may have high cholesterols that have not been controlled, and or they smoke. And if they've got any combination of that, the likelihood they're going to have stiff vessels is very high.
Fascinating. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for in today's episode. I'd like to thank you, Professor George Bakris, for taking the time to share with us your insights, and I look forward to continuing our discussion next week when we'll delve further into diabetes-related kidney disease and the future of nephrology. So folks, please subscribe so you never miss an episode. Check out the archives. There's loads of great content on there. Tell your friends, like us on social media, blah, blah, blah. You know the score. And join us next week for another fascinating episode of the EMJ podcast. I'm Dr. Jonathan Sakya. Please, everyone, stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.